Welcome to Cardicast, a glam podcast brought to you by New Cardigan. You can become a member of New Cardigan on our website at newcardigan.org. We also have merchandise available. Buy a t-shirt and support this volunteer-run, not-for-profit organisation. Today we have Brendan Taylor, who's a preparator at Museums Victoria, here with us. Brendan, I'm just going to start with the first question. Can you tell me a little bit about yourself? What led you to become a preparator?
I always had an interest in art, I guess. It started, obviously, a long time when I was a kid growing up. And I grew up in Tasmania. And I remember my mum buying me an airbrush for my 16th birthday. So that kind of spawned the whole thing, I guess. I was sort of involved with motorcycles quite a lot when I was young. And I was painting motorbikes and all sorts of things. If anyone put something in front of me, I'd paint it. And so from that, I did that for a number of years and then moved to Victoria and got a job in heavy industry for a year. And I thought, well, that's something I don't want to do for the rest of my life. So then I went to art school, ended up doing graduate studies, then a postgraduate year. And my lecturer at the time said, well, Brendan, what are you going to do when you leave? And I said, well, I don't know. So he said, oh, I think you'd be good at prop making. He goes, what if we send you off to the ABC prop making studios? And I said, okay. This is a long story, by the way. He said, okay, I'll arrange it for you. So I went down and did a week's work experience at the ABC prop making studios. And I liked it so much, I asked him if I could stay another week. So I stayed an extra week, went back, and I thought, right, this is really good. I can apply all of my art skills and things into something that I think I could make a living out of. So it sort of ticked all those boxes. So I heard about a prop making company. I got in contact with them, ended up getting a job with them. I was with them for 8 years, and then I went freelancing for about 3 years, and then during that time the museum sent out invitations for applicants for a position in the preparators department. So I nearly didn't do it because it required things like taxidermy skills and stuff like that, and I didn't have any of those. So I thought, oh, well, I'll give it a try anyway. Anyway, I got in. I was one of four people, and that's how I ended up at the museum. I've been there ever since, probably 17 or 18 years now, so yeah.
What were your thoughts when you thought, okay, I've never had any experience in taxidermy or autopsies or any kind of medical training. Mm. What kind of leap did you think you would have to take to sort of going from sort of a sculptor arts, you know, working with motorbikes and other industries? What sort of thought was going through your mind? Where are my skills transferable in terms of medical kind of autopsies and taxidermy work?
Well, I had absolutely no clue about taxidermy skills or anything like that. I just thought, look, I'll give it a go and I'll just learn. If I need to, I'll just learn as I go along. And that's basically how they do their training anyway. So you kind of learn it through osmosis, you know, just by being around other people, and they show you how to do things and you just sort of pick things up. In our department, we do a lot of different things. Like we do model making, we do habitat reconstruction, we do moulding and casting, painting. We do the whole lot, as well as taxidermy. So taxidermy is a part of what we do, but it's, well, the last couple of years it's been a fairly big focus because there's, for a really long time, the department was focused on just doing exhibition-based things, which I really love. So that was really good, but we never really got the opportunity to develop our taxidermy skills. And one of the guys in our department is like the guru of taxidermy. And so we thought, you know, the boss thought, well, okay, we've got to sit everyone down and get him to train everyone up, because he was going for working 2 days a week. So he was sort of being at the museum less. So it was probably a good time to train, get all our skills up to scratch. And of course, not everyone's going to be perfect at that sort of thing, and I'm certainly not. But we all sort of have different skills that sort of we prefer or are good at. but the whole team sort of pulls together and we can all do a bit of everything. We all also have things that we sort of specialise in, so, and which makes us a little bit different from a lot of other museums around Australia, because they tend to specialise just in one thing. The one person might just do taxidermy, one person might do skin studies, one person might do skeleton studies, one person will do this, you know. But in our department, we cover the whole thing. Everyone does a bit of everything, so, yeah.
That's fantastic. So the person that was training in taxidermy, what's his name, sorry?
That's Dean Smith.
And he's been at the museum a long time as well?
Yes, since he left school. So he's been there a really long time, yeah.
And you need those mentors, don't you? Especially working in a in preparation and the preparators at work, like you were explaining with your team, everyone sort of trains up in different areas, but they have sort of expertise and, you know, in different parts of the work that you do.
That's right.
And you've recently got a new staff member as well, is that right?
Yep, Sarah Smith, and she's the newest member of the preparators team. So, and she already had a lot of skills, so which is why she ended up with the job, and she's a really nice person too, so, you know, that all helps. And, yeah, I think we're a really good tight-knit team. There's only six of us, so, you know, we spread our work between. It's mainly Melbourne Museum, but we also work for Science Works and Immigration Museum as well, so we cover a pretty broad range of areas and skills and all sorts of things. So, yeah, it's good.
My next question is, what is your vision for the GLAM galleries, libraries, archives and museum sector? Do you have a vision, or is your vision more for how preparation is going, what the direction in your department?
I guess it's more about where our department is going. We're trying to develop our skills. Like we're doing, trying to skill up in 3D printing now, so and more digital sort of things, and how that can be used. Like everything, it's just a tool, but we can, you know, that becomes part of our toolbox. So anything that can help the work, we sort of try and pick up, and that includes, you know, different materials and things that might come on the market. We have to try and keep up with all sorts of different plastics and moulding and casting materials and paints and all sorts of stuff. So, yeah.
So the wild exhibition at Melbourne Museum, I think recently some of the specimens from that exhibition have been scanned, 3D scanned, is that right?
Yeah, some of them were 3D scanned. There was a the small rhinoceros in particular that was scanned. And during the school holidays, my boss actually took the scan of the baby rhino and 3D printed it at a certain size, as well as some other animals, and sort of modified it, exaggerated some parts. And from that 3D print, I made a mould out of silicon, or a number of moulds out of the silicon, and for the public program. So the kids would come in, it was a two-part mould, they'd get plasticine and push it into both halves, push it together, and then they'd end up with a little critter. And the older kids could go off and then do a 3D stop frame animation of it. So that's, yeah, part of what we do as well. We help out with the, there's outreach as well, there's public programs, there's, you know, all sorts of things going on. But yeah, a lot of the stuff we've got digital records of now. So there was a basking shark that got caught in a net a couple of years ago now. And fortunately, the fisherman got in contact with the museum and said, you guys might be interested in this. And I had to go down with some other people from the museum, take the head off this thing, and it was huge. But once we got it back to the museum, we scanned that as well. So we've got a digital record of that. So at some stage, we'd like to build the thing. Whether it'll be life-size or not, I'm not really sure at this stage, but the records are there and ready to go. So, yeah.
And the specimen, the basking shark, is also part of the state collection now?
Yes, the head is. The rest of it was just too big. We had a trailer and it was just the head we could fit in the trailer and it just fit. so we couldn't bring the rest back, but they took tissue samples, and because there isn't a lot of information about these animals, and a lot of the times the fishermen might catch these things accidentally, but they sort of throw them back and hope no one's noticed. But this guy had the nous to sort of ring us up and said, oh, look, you guys might be interested in this. And it's a really good way of finding out more information about the animals and trying to get an understanding of, you know, what they do and how they live and stuff, so we can better protect them, I guess.
What's the largest animal that you've worked on in your time at the museum?
It would have to be the blue whale that's on display out in the main foyer. When I started work there, it had already been processed, but I helped put the skeleton together. Well, I put all the ribs on. that was a big job. That was absolutely enormous. And in our department, we got photos. We got like a pin-up board, and we got photos of how it was all retrieved. There were two bulldozers had to push it up the beach and load it onto a big trailer. And then it was taken out to Werribee, where it was fleshed down, and then put into the ponds out there to let the bacteria just do its work, so it just eats all the flesh off, and we retrieve the bones out. And then normally when whales wash up and things like that, you know, we've got to be opportunists sometime. We'll get a phone call and say, there's a whale that's washed up such and such a place. Do you want it? And we'll find out what it is. And if it's one that we might not have many in the collection, we'll go, yeah, we'll have it. And depending on where it's washed up, depends on what we do with it. Sometimes we have to bring it back to the museum or take it somewhere. Often we'll take them to the local tip to flesh it down there. That way they can just dig a big hole, put all the remains in the hole, and we're just left with the bones. Or if it's a remote beach, we try and bury the specimen on the beach and just let nature take its course and go back, like, you know, 10 months later and dig it up and bring the bones back again. But most of the things go into the collections. They don't normally get articulated and put on display because that's a huge amount of money and it's a lot of time.
So the blue whale, I've noticed at Melbourne Museum, sometimes there's a little bit of fat conjoling from the jaw, I think.
Yes.
And that's because it was put into vats and boiled, is that right? Or
most of the skeleton was taken to South Australia and they had these big vats there and they had a special chemical, which has been banned now because it's nasty. But the skull and mandibles were too big for the tank. So we, at some stage, before it was articulated or put together, all the bones were out at our storage facility at Moreland, and myself and another guy were going out and trying to get rid of all the oil, because it's just all the oil that's in the bones. It just leaks out. It runs like a tap. And we're trying to get as much out as we could. So what we were doing was going out there with big tubs of acetone and soaking the acetone into cotton wool and wrapping the cotton wool around the bones and then wrapping tin foil around that. And while we're doing this, we're all suited up in breathing apparatus with air feeds and stuff. And we're also scrubbing the bones down with the acetone and scrubbing brushes. But we would sort of using up more oxygen than was being fed to us. So we'd sort of have to run away, like after about 10 minutes, and rip the mask off and take some deep breaths and put it back on and go back in. But yeah, it's only just recently stopped running out. And that's why it's got the big black stain underneath. That's actually the oil being, through gravity, just being brought to the bottom of the mandibles, yeah.
Okay, what current projects are you working on, Brendan? You mentioned a school program with the modelling that was done for school groups. Are there any other projects that you're really working on currently that you'd like to share?
As I said, we're sort of trying to skill up on our taxidermy sort of skills, and so there's been a big focus on that recently. So that covers a whole range of things, and we're always working on skin studies and skeleton studies anyway, but there's been a bit of a focus on the taxidermy, the actual, because they're all related, but the ultimate is taxidermy, when you end up with a finished specimen that's stuffed, basically, for want of a better word. They're not actually stuffed, they're actually, the bodies are carefully made and But they, it's people just say that stuff because that's what they used to do in the old days. They would just cram them full of grass or whatever they could find. These days, the bodies are made up. Like, we're quite careful about recreating the bodies accurately and trying to get the best result we can. But that sort of stuff takes a bit of time to learn. And as I said, with Dean there, he's pretty good at that sort of stuff. So we luckily have him on our team.
So Dean also does workshops, doesn't he, for all groups come into the museum? I don't know if Dean runs those workshops for people to learn taxidermy, because there's no place that you can learn taxidermy at a university course or other institutions. Is that right?
There are places around, but okay. They're few and far between. One of the issues is that you got to have the right permits to collect. You're not obviously not allowed to collect Australian species. Everything's protected, so unless you've got a special permit, the museum has a special permit, so we can go out and get specimens. Well, most of the specimens we get are donated anyway. All the birds and things that we get, usually roadkill or window strikes or things like that. But sometimes we'll have groups through, and either Dean or whoever is available or whoever has the most skills in that area will sort of talk about various things. So we do have back of house. It's not very often, but we do have back of house tours and things that people can come and look at. So.
And there's training that's over a few days, is that right? Or
when you say training, it's not actually training. Okay. They're more demonstrations.
Okay.
So training would be the whole new ball game, and
sure,
it'd be a bit difficult for us to sort of manage all of that stuff as well as do our normal day-to-day activities. So
if our listeners are interested in coming along to one of those back of house tours, I think they would be advertised on the museum's Victoria website,
and yes,
they sort of happen every few months or maybe a couple of times a year.
Yeah, usually a couple of times a year. They have the nocturnal things happening every last, it's the last Friday of it, every month, and they have different people speaking and giving demonstrations, and sometimes we've been part of those sort of things as well. So, but they might have one thing 1 month, and then they'll have another thing the next month. So it sort of depends
on the theme of the nocturnal. So yes. I think nocturnal is the first. Is it the first Friday of every month? I'm not sure. We can definitely, if you're listening to this podcast, please have a look on our website or the Museum's Victoria website. When I say our, I work at the museum as well with Brendan. One other thing I wanted to ask you is, what are your passions at work and outside of work? I mean, maybe your passions might collide, I guess, in your sculpture work as well.
I wouldn't say they collide. They sort of complement each other, really. I found that I still practice my own sculpture, so and that translates into the sort of stuff that I do at the museum as well, and vice versa. Sometimes when we come across a new product at work, I instantly think, oh, how can I use this in my own work? But there's definitely a crossover there, and it goes both ways. So, and that's what I find really exciting and interesting about working there. And there's just so much stuff that goes on. I just started recently a series of works based on this exploration I had of the abyss about a year or two ago now. And I'm really kind of interested in the deep sea fish and things like that. They're just really so alien and so amazing. I spoke to one of the scientists when they came back from doing this expedition, and I said, "Oh look, I think there could be some great material here for my own work." And she actually had a website called Fishers of Australia that she puts all this information on, and pictures and things, and she said, well, maybe that could be a good inspiration. So I've started doing a series of works based on these bioluminescent animals that live in the deep sea, and that's been really interesting. Before she left, she gave us a polystyrene cup, and she said, do you want to send a cup down to the abyss?
And was this Dibray that you're talking about?
Yes, Dibray. I thought she was joking at first. Anyway, she said, if you just do a little picture or something, draw something on the cup and we'll send it down. And I didn't really have any idea what that meant. But anyway, she brought the thing back, and it's about, a quarter of the size because of the pressure down there, and you just end up with this little miniature cup, and it's still got the drawing on it and the writing and stuff. And so I just blew my mind. I thought that's really amazing. So just to have something that went down there and was sharing a space with those animals down there was pretty awesome. So I did one sculpture based on the hatchet fish, and it all lit up and was made out of metal. Di ended up buying it off me anyway, so...
Will you be exhibiting some of this work, do you think, in the future?
It's going very slowly at the moment, so hopefully. I've been doing a series of works based on human hearts as well, so I've got a massive heart out in the backyard I've got to do something with, and I've got other bits and pieces scattered around the state, so I've got a... I've been thinking about getting them all back and maybe having an exhibition somewhere. Because we used to have a number of artists at... Well, there are a number of artists at the museum, and we used to have an organisation called The Collective. We would have group shows, but that's sort of fallen apart lately, and so I thought, well, maybe I should just organise something of my own, but it's just a matter of finding the time and, yeah, getting the energy to do it.
Can people find you online, your art practice? Is there a website that they can go to?
I actually don't have a website. I know that's pretty slack, but I seem to think that if I've got enough time to get on the computer, I've got time to be working on my sculpture. So it's probably a bit of a bad attitude, really. But
more time for your art sounds like.
Yeah,
a good
thing. Well, you know, that's the priority, really. So. Yeah, but I'll get around to it one day. But I was part of the Contemporary Sculptors Association, but I forgot about it and let my membership lapse, so I've got to get back on. But I did have a number of images on their website. But so, yeah.
So maybe if you rejoin there in the future, people can find your folio on that website?
I was actually thinking about it on the way here. I thought I should get in contact with those people again and join up.
Final question for the day. What's your favourite book, film, exhibition, podcast, conference, music, album that you're listening to, or something that you're really enjoying at the moment?
Well, I've just finished reading a book called Chromatopia by David Coles. It's all about the history of colour, and it's one of the most fantastic things I've ever read. It was just fantastic, and... yeah, got a real lot of enjoyment out of that. And his story is about various colours and the history of them. It sounds a bit boring. I'm telling my wife about this book, and she's going, oh, yeah, you know. And then I started explaining some of the things. She goes, wow, that sounds pretty good, actually. Just the political things around colour and stuff like that. It was just amazing, and
Has it made you think about colour in your own work in a different way, do you think?
Yeah, I guess it has. I actually spoke to this guy one day, because at the museum in our department, we actually, because he's a paint maker, and he works, he's got two places here in Melbourne where he supplies his paint, and we actually buy stuff off him. I went in there, one of my own projects is the big heart that I was telling you about. It has all these big pipes, PVC pipes coming off it, and that lead into the ground, but I didn't want them to look like PVC, and the sculpture probably stands almost human height, so it's fairly big, but I wanted the pipes to look like they're made out of copper. So went in there and told him what I was doing. He goes, here you go, and just handed me two things straight off, and they were exactly the colours I was after, and to get that kind of patinaed look, and he knew exactly what I wanted. And
was this someone that was working at the museum, or is it someone that you met outside the museum?
Well, he's outside the museum. He runs his company, just making artists' oils, actually, oil paints. But he also gets supplies of... brings in golden paints, which I think they're made in America or somewhere, and they're water-based paints. So we use a lot of water-based paints at the museum too, because we try to keep the... We've got a whole range of oil paints as well, but... We try and use things that are low toxicity and stuff like that. So we're very careful about the materials that we use, because we use such a large range of plastics and things like that. We're really careful about what we use. So So we get all our supplies off him. So, and it was just through having conversations with him. And I didn't even realise at the time that it was him that wrote the book. It was only when I started reading the book, I said, I think I know this guy. I've spoken to him. And
serendipity.
Yeah, there you go.
Something that I find really interesting about the work of preparators is the colour work that you do with existing specimens. I don't know if you do that yourself, Brendan, but you know, matching colours of a living specimen to a specimen that's in the collection to give it that look. You know, obviously, once an animal has died, it loses its colour. Is that right?
Yeah.
I'm not sure if I'm explaining that very
well. No, that's exactly right. There's a couple of ways of preserving things. One is obviously taking the skins off and doing it that way, taxidermy, but some animals don't respond to that very well. And we've got a freeze dryer as well, so you can freeze dry things, which takes all the moisture out, but it's only if something's got a robust skin. The freeze dryer works like any fruit and nuts, you know, it's all been dehydrated basically. So it's the same sort of process, it's the same machine. But as I said, it'll only work if the specimen's got a robust skin. So things like reptiles, we usually mould and cast. People often get a bit upset that they're not the real things, but by doing it that way, we get the best representation of that specimen we can, and we have a lot of photographs and details about that particular specimen. And we'll go full on into getting everything as accurate as we can. For instance, tiger snakes have a... we put glass eyes and everything because the eyes obviously one of the first things to sort of decay. So we put glass eyes in. We mould and cast them. So we pour silicone over them and we make them out of fiberglass basically. So, and then we go to a lot of trouble to get all the colours right. The glass eyes go in, and even with the tiger snakes have around their pupil, they have a gold ring. We even paint the gold rings in. Things like that. We go to a lot of trouble to get all the detail right. So they're extremely accurate as far as the actual specimen that they'll moulded from.
You can even feel it when you pick up one of those, you know, moulded specimens, like the weight and the texture of the skin. I mean, I don't know from, I haven't touched a lot of reptiles myself, but you can, you get the sense that it has that, like a weight of an animal. It's not a light object.
Yeah. It depends whether it's going to be handled or not. A lot of artefacts that we, because we do replicas of all sorts of things. It's gold nuggets, there's all sorts of artefacts and things like that. And something's going to be handled. Obviously, it's hard to make gold feel as heavy as gold because gold, there aren't any things as heavy as gold. So, but what we do to give it some weight, we'll put lead in it and we'll sort of incorporate that into the cast. So to give it a bit of weight at least, so people get the sensation of it being quite heavy. Normally, we don't do it with the reptiles and things because they tend to be fairly fragile and they can, like toes and or tails can break and things like that. And usually if they are going to be handled, we'll make them out of a flexible material. So if the toes or tails do get bumped, they're not going to snap off. They'll just bend. And so that's another thing we have to do. We have to be really careful about the sort of materials that we use when we're doing these things. So
wonderful. Thank you so much, Brendan. Thank you for coming in on a sunny Sunday afternoon to talk to us.
That's okay.
Really appreciate it. That was Brendan Taylor, preparator at Museums Victoria. You can contact Brendan through Curious or the Discovery Centre at Melbourne Museum. Thanks so much for listening. We hope you've enjoyed this interview. Subscribe to CardiCast on iTunes and review us. Keep an ear out for future CardiCast episodes and visit our website newcardigan.org for more information. And remember, folks, JFDI.